Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
The National Labor Relations Board continues to stand up to Amazon. Meanwhile, a step forward for workers in Connecticut. And today on the show, the General President of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America, and the latest from the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. Welcome to the Monday, May 23rd edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. Carl Rosen is going to be our first guest on the show today. He is the General President of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. Website is ueunion.org. Carl has been a member of the union since 1984. When he joined Local 190 in Chicago upon being hired at Kerr Glass. He worked there for 10 years as a maintenance electrician, served in various positions for the local, and that included steward, publicity and education director, chief steward, bargaining committee member, and president. In 1994, he was elected UE District 11 president, and when 11, District 11, that is, was succeeded by the Western Region. In 2006, he was elected as regional president, then elected general president in 2019. We got a couple things we're going to zero in on. The current labor shortage, how that has given workers leverage, the upper hand with management, which is a first in decades. However, Carl says workers will only be able to take full advantage of what's going on right now if they engage in organized struggles to secure gains. He's going to talk about one win recently at MIT for graduate workers. And this has been happening all around the country. A number of unions are aligning with graduate students at various colleges, many of them very prestigious, this one, MIT. And last month, the students voted to unionize with almost 1,800 votes cast for the move and 912 against it. And they had a lot of issues in that strike. Carl will run them down. But this is just another example of how unions are reaching out to various sectors. During the pandemic, many workers, groups of workers, non-union, walked off the job to demand safe working conditions. Well, we'll talk about that. Striketober, Strike November. We'll talk about worker power and what this union did a couple of years ago, right in the middle of the pandemic. In 2020, the UE published a booklet called Them and Us Unionism. Them and Us Unionism, which draws on their history to identify five core principles of the union's approach to unionism. Number one, and we'll get into detail on all of this, aggressive struggle. Number two, rank and file control. Number three, political independence. Number four, international solidarity. And lastly, uniting all workers. That's what it's all about. So Carl Rosen, General President of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America, joining us as our first guest. Greg Regan will be joining us later in the show. He's one of our regulars. He comes to us from the Transportation Trades Department of the Labor Federation, which is a collection of, my gosh, about three dozen unions. And again, I want to salute the ironworkers for joining the TTD. TTD.org is the website. We're going to talk about the importance of the U.S. maritime industry and the workforce and the issue with the railroads. This is huge. It really is. One of the biggest reasons probably why we have a supply chain problem in America. Greg called out the freight rail companies in his recent testimony before the Surface Transportation Board. He spoke with members of the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, Transportation Workers. That's part of SMART. And the rail industry's workforce, he said, has been depleted in recent years as the major rail carriers pursued what they call precision scheduled railroading, PSR. And what that does, it limits the workforce. And he's explained it on the show. I'm going to let him talk more about it when we join him later on. But right now, and Greg said this in testimony, today's freight rail network is not working for anyone other than the investors in the railroad. So he called on the Surface Transportation Board to take a more active role to fix the problem. And if the board requires more authority or clarity from Congress, they should request it. Something's got to happen. Because once again, you're seeing Wall Street take over an industry, chop it up into bits, and it's not functioning properly. And one of the issues has been the attendance situation. The workers are overworked. They're working 6-7 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day. If they take a day off or sick time, they get docked. What kind of job is that? I know they're making money, but they have to hire more. And it's just not happening. So he's going to delve into that. Greg Regan, the president of the Transportation Trades Department. Great organization. TTD.org is their website. Lots of news about Amazon today. First off, NLRB prosecutors intend on issuing a complaint against the company for unfair labor practices. The NLRB's regional director of the Brooklyn office accused Amazon of threatening to pay staff minimum wages if they unionized, and for retaliating against an employee for advocating for a paid holiday on Juneteenth at one of the Staten Island facilities in New York. That's the one that voted for the union. On the first issue, the regional director concluded that Amazon held captive audience meetings where it threatened that Amazon couldn't use the minimum wage as the floor for collective bargaining, which would be down from $18 an hour to the local minimum wage of $15 an hour. So they would have to start there and move up. Pretty sneaky, huh? As Seth Goldstein, lawyer for the Amazon Labor Union, has stated, this could be the case for the NLRB to find that captive audience meetings are in violation of the National Labor Relations Act, which is in line with the general counsel's memo on April 7th. That general counsel would be Jennifer Abruzzo. On the second issue, the regional director determined that Amazon retaliated against a worker who used the voice of the associate board at the warehouse to ask for a holiday on Juneteenth by prohibiting that worker from using the board in the future. They're really getting into the nitty-gritty here. In the meantime, the state of New York is filing a complaint against Amazon accusing the company of discriminating against pregnant workers and workers with disabilities. New York's Division of Human Rights filed a complaint alleging that instead of accommodations, the company forces them to take unpaid leaves of absence. Listen to this. The New York agency listed instances of situations where the company failed to accommodate these workers. For example, one pregnant worker received an accommodation not to lift anything over 25 pounds. However, the manager refused to honor the accommodation, so she was forced to keep lifting. Worse yet, she became injured at work, and instead of agreeing to additional accommodations, Amazon simply forced her on unpaid leave. The state of New York alleges this conduct violates New York's human rights law and demands that Amazon pay civil fines and penalties to the state of New York and stop the conduct altogether. Wow. Last week, the University of California Berkeley Labor Center issued a new report by international labor law expert Lance Compa on Amazon's efforts to prevent its workers from forming unions. That report, titled Failure to Deliver assessing Amazon's freedom of association policy under international labor standards compares the company's policies and practices with the company's human rights obligations as defined by the United Nations. Well, this week, which will be Wednesday, May 25th, shareholders will vote on a proposal that urges the company to issue a report on whether its human rights policies and practices respect the freedom of Amazon's workers to form unions. The corporation is urging shareholders to vote against the proposal. No surprise there. In 2021, their CEO, Andrew Jassy, received $212 million in total compensation compared to Amazon's medium employee pay of $32,855. So you know what that means? The CEO to employee ratio at Amazon is 1 to 6,474. You know, the average in the country right now is anywhere between 1 in 300, maybe 1 in 400. At Amazon, it's 1 in 6,474. Got an update here out of the state of Connecticut. Last week, we did a show with Ed Hawthorne. Ed comes from AFSCME, and he's the current president of the Connecticut AFL-CIO, and we were talking about what they did with regard to captive audience meetings. Well, the governor there, Ned Lamont, signed into law, this was last Friday, a bill to outlaw employers from forcing workers to attend closed-door captive audience meetings in their attempt to bust organizing campaigns. Again, that was led by Ed Hawthorne, who we had on the show. That would be the May 16th edition. And if you missed it, just go to awfpodcast.com. That's our new website where we archive all of the shows. You can still access through awfradio.com, but if you go to awfpodcast.com, you could listen to that that interview. That was a good interview with Ed Hawthorne. He said, in just over 6 weeks, workers will no longer be forced to attend meetings about their employer's position on politics, religion, or union organizing. As only the second state in the nation to take action, Connecticut is leading the way in protecting the rights of working people. Oregon did that about 10 years ago. So Connecticut followed the lead, and hats off to the governor for signing that legislation. Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont. Again, that show archived on awfpodcast.com. Quick break. When we come back, we're going to link up with Carl Rosen, who heads the Union of Electronic, Radio, and Machine Workers. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency. Always trying to connect people with employment, good wages, great benefits. ulagency.org is our website. Let's go to Chicago, Illinois right now. And joining us on line number one is Carl Rosen, who is the general president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. 30,000 strong, and as he put it, a feisty union. I like that. Carl Rosen, welcome to the show. How are we doing today, my brother?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
And I see you became president a couple of years ago, 2019, and a year before the pandemic caused a shutdown in America. I'll get into that. But let's talk a little bit about Carl Rosen. I see you're a member since 1984 when you joined Local 190 in Chicago, and that was Kerr Glass. What made you decide to go into that line of work? Let's start right there.
Well, I had already been working for about 3 years as a maintenance electrician in various different workplaces, and frankly applied to this one because it had good hours and was close to my home and didn't have any mandatory overtime, and that was the magic things for me. But I grew up in a household that was very strongly believed in union organizing, community organizing. Both of my parents were involved in that, and it seemed to me, especially in this era of Ronald Reagan being supreme and basically attacking both of those things, that somebody needed to get involved and help do that. So I felt that it made sense for me to use my skills, what I could do day to day as a worker, as a maintenance electrician, to do that, but also to be talking to people about how to build their unions.
So it sounds like you got real active in your union right away when you were working at Kerr Glass then. Is that what that's
well,
what it...
yes and no. I mean, I paid my dues like everyone else and spent my day doing my work as I was assigned to by my employer. But, there were occasions where, we would have to engage with the supervisor about this or that. And when a vacancy came up for steward, somebody said, "Hey, how about that Carl? He seems to have a mouth on him. He should be our steward." and it kind of started there. And eventually I served in various other, all volunteer elected positions within the local. I was the publicity and education director for a while. I filled in as chief steward for a while the chief steward was on medical leave. I was on the bargaining grievance committee and eventually was elected president of the local when the woman who had served for quite a while said she was ready for a break and kind of tapped me on the shoulder. It was that kind of local, about 120 people, and we all looked out for each other, and part of it was looking to make sure that if you were going to step aside, that there was somebody else who was going to step up, because we didn't want to let the local get weakened in any way.
Well, that mouth got you all the way to general president. That's pretty good. And that happened in 2019. A year later, the pandemic caused a shutdown in the country. How did that affect the UE?
Right. It was really more like only 4 months later. I had barely had a chance to settle in at our national headquarters in Pittsburgh at all, because I'd been on the road with some important negotiations out in California for the union. And then we just, we shut down all of our travel almost immediately, asked our staff and our locals to figure out ways to do things remotely as much as possible. Contracts that were coming up immediately, we asked employers to consider basically one-year extensions with a small wage increase where possible, or whatever wage increase we could get, obviously, but they weren't large ones at that point as the economy was going into freefall that spring. But then we got into a lot of fights in a lot of places around just preserving people's health. We had employers that were not taking any of the steps that were needed in terms of social distancing or masking once that was brought to everybody's attention as the best way to protect folks. And there was a question of, allowing workers to stay home with pay once either they were sick or they were exposed to others who were sick as being the best way to protect everyone. We had to tussle with many employers over that, but we won protections in a number of those places, and places where our members were directly facing the public, where there was no question, like in a grocery store, say, for example, there was no question that you were going to be able to totally socially distanced. We won hazard pay in a number of those places, et cetera. We have a very diverse membership at this point, working in all kinds of industries and occupations. So it very much varied from workplace to workplace what steps needed to be taken. But we put a lot of information up on our website and spread it out to our membership in terms of what they could be doing to kind of help themselves. And we instructed our staff to work with them as much as possible to do so. And in parallel with that, our organizing department was recognizing that there were workers all over the place who were calling in who were just desperate for assistance. They frequently weren't in a situation where they were going to be prepared to organize a union anytime soon, but they needed to put demands on their employers for these same protections immediately. So we started giving them advice on what their legal rights were, et cetera, so that they could speak collectively to their boss and or go to the public if necessary to put pressure on their employer. And out of this grew a campaign called the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which we did in concert with the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. We'd kind of met up with through the Bernie Sanders for President campaign that spring of 2020. And we started realizing we were getting the same kind of calls and trying to give the same kind of assistance to workers. So we set up what we call EWOC now, and it's helped thousands of workers across the country improve their immediate conditions on the job, and in some cases go on to organizing drives with various unions. And it's very low staff driven and almost all volunteer driven. It's the distributed model of organizing that was used in the Sanders campaign, and we have people who are union staff, union officers, just activists, et cetera, people who know a little bit or a lot about union organizing, who will follow up when leads come in and kind of triage what kind of assistance do these folks need, get them to the right people with the experience to help them in that situation. And it's made a big difference for a lot of workers.
You know what that sounds like? It sounds like what the workers did over at the Amazon facility in Staten Island. And it was pretty much bottom up instead of top down.
This is exactly right. I mean, I think the two great themes that the labor movement has to understand right now, one is, and I think some segments do, is that workers are prepared for and must self-organize. We don't have enough union organizers in this country to organize on the kind of scale we need to restore labor's power in this country. And we've dropped from a third of the workforce in the private sector having unions to I think somewhere around 6% now. That, you know, we just don't have the leverage we need to have. We aren't going to be able to do it one workplace at a time by union staff going in great numbers and doing it. Workers need to self-organize. Workers can self-organize when motivated and when given the inspiration and the examples. And this is how the labor movement was organized in the 1930s. And the other great theme right now is that workers are ready to do it, especially the younger generation. People who have come into the workforce in this century, they have just seen disappointment out of this economic system that we have here, how much corporate power there is relative to worker power when you aren't unionized. And they're ready to make a change. They are not expecting that this economy is going to take care of them on its own. The only way workers are going to get a fair shake, are going to have a chance to go move ahead, or chance to have a living standard that is even at least equal to their parents, and it ought to be substantially better because productivity does keep increasing, and that's how we improve people's standards of living. The only way to do it is through unionizing, and we're seeing that, and that's why you're seeing places like Amazon organizing, places like Starbucks organizing, places like where we just organized recently, where, you know, in the past nobody would have thought it might have happened, but we just organized over 3,700 graduate workers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in just outside Boston in Cambridge. And there's 900 additional fellows there who will be organizing in with UE next. And this is exactly, you know, that demographic. And people have grown up in these times and realize, yes, even though they work at you know, a very privileged university, they still need a union to make sure that their needs are addressed and that they can speak in a collective voice instead of only as an individual.
It's funny you mention that, too, because in my experience doing this show, it seems the more prestigious universities, the stingier they are, especially with workers and grad students, to your point. Let's talk about that, if you don't mind. Did those students reach out to you? Because you mentioned about the diversity of your union. And when you talk about the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America, you don't think about graduate students at MIT. How did that happen?
No, although a funny story, I did tell them that UE started out as a union in the 1930s for companies like Westinghouse and GE in Sylvania, which were in many ways the high-tech companies of that era. So
you're right, yeah.
But that wasn't the reason they contacted us. The reason they contacted us is we have a history that also goes back to our roots of being a very democratic, rank-and-file controlled union. Where members in their locals can make their own decisions on, what sorts of things they want to support politically, how they're going to carry out their fight with their employer, what they're going to settle for and what they're not going to settle for. We don't, as a national union, come in and threaten to trustee them for, political points of view that they take, et cetera. And we encourage them to act as much on their own two feet as possible. And so that level of local autonomy is what they were looking for. Find it with UE. They have all the support of a national union, all the experience that comes with that, and skilled staff and skilled professional assistants and traditions that they can make to their, remake to their own needs. Yet they also have the local autonomy that will let them make the decisions they see best fit for their membership, and that's really what makes a union strongest. Is when members feel it's their union, they're making the decisions, they have ownership of it. Then they don't get cynical about what's going on.
And that was a heck of a vote too. It was 2-1 that happened last month. Did you know it was going to be that strong there?
We knew within a very few votes. The number we were going to get, we knew we were going to get a little over 1,700. I believe it came in around 1,770, 1,780, around that. What we just didn't know exactly was the opposition vote that the administration had been trying to encourage, to say the least, because this is a workplace that's very spread out, to say the least. So not only is it over this huge campus with many people locked away in labs where you really aren't supposed to be going in there if you don't work right in that lab, but people who because of the pandemic, many of them were remote. Not even geographically in the area. Some of them had research projects that would take them elsewhere. So it was very hard to be in contact with absolutely everybody. But it was just as hard for the administration as it was for us to reach a lot of those folks, I guess, because they turned out a relatively small vote no population, and we ended up winning by a 2-1 margin, which was great.
Well, hats off to you. Carl Rosen joining us on our live line, General President of the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America. Carl, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about your booklet, Them and Us Unionism. Carl Rosen, again, General President of the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America. Greg Regan will be joining us later in the show on behalf of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Iron Workers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 iron workers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union iron workers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our iron workers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at uaw.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate a five-star rating, so keep them coming. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Let's go back to Chicago right now. Rejoin Carl Rosen. Carl is the general president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America, 30,000 strong, ueunion.org. You can follow them there on Twitter as well. They also have a Facebook presence. Carl, I want to talk about this booklet that came out a couple of years ago, but you got to talk about this campaign. We're going back to when the financial markets collapsed, the housing markets. This is 2007, 2008. And I remember this story. I did not know that your union was involved, though. Republic Windows and Doors. This was right outside your hometown of Chicago. What happened there, Carl? Can you refresh my memory on this one?
Sure. This was late 2008. It was while the economy was in free fall, I should say. You had banks on the edge of collapse, and so huge amounts of taxpayer money were being handed out to them like lollipops by the federal government. And meanwhile, businesses that actually employed people were closing down, and millions of workers were being laid off, especially in factories across the country, and nothing was being done for the workers. And we saw this freight train about to smash into about 275 workers at a window manufacturing plant that we represented in Chicago, and mostly Black and Latino workforce, a large number of immigrants, and we started talking to folks about, we saw equipment being moved out of the plant, other things happening that didn't look right. And the management, hushed up, wouldn't talk to us. We knew they had a large line of credit from the Bank of America, which was at that point getting billions and billions, I think probably hundreds of billions of dollars in bailout funds from the federal government. They wouldn't talk to us. And so we organized the workers to do something that just isn't done very often anymore, in part because it's been made illegal under, which it absolutely shouldn't be, but under the laws of this country that are stacked against workers, which is essentially to sit down inside the plant and say, we aren't leaving until we get our problems adjusted. And so as the workers were being told, your job is gone, and oh, by the way, we aren't going to pay you that vacation pay you're owed, and oh, by the way, the 2 months health insurance we had promised you is evaporated. In fact, you may not have health insurance when you walk out the door today. And oh, by the way, the 2 months of WARN Act pay that you're supposed to get on a plant closing of this size, you're not going to get that. It was just like everything they were supposed to get, they weren't getting. The workers were fed up because we'd been organizing amongst them to stand up for themselves for a number of years. They said, we're staying right here in this place until we get some answers we like. They sent their bargaining committee, and I went along with them down to the bank to discuss it, because now, after the workers didn't leave and we called the media and said, hey, there's a couple hundred workers holed up in here and they ain't leaving, all of a sudden it became a local news story. And by the next day, it became a national news story. And who was in the headlines was the bank, because they were getting this bailout and the workers weren't. And that led to the coining of the phrase, the banks got bailed out, we got sold out, which went on to be the inspiration for the theme, I guess you would say, of the folks who were protested on Wall Street, et cetera, down the road, Occupy Wall Street, that spread to many other cities. But it what it immediately did here was it galvanized people all over the country, and folks began protesting outside Bank of America branches all over the country. And some were going in and doing sit-ins and getting arrested in them, even people we didn't know, but we loved because they were standing in solidarity with these workers. And within a very few days, the bank said, "We want to take care of this," and they came up along with another bank. They came up with almost $2 million that were needed to pay what the workers were owed. And that took care of those workers in their immediate needs. And then eventually the plant even reopened a few months later under new ownership that was hoping to take advantage of some of the green economy spending under the Obama administration. That didn't fully make it. And since that time, a group of the workers took a big chunk of the equipment and started a co-op, a worker-owned co-op making windows, and it still exists today, New Era Windows in Chicago. It's on a smaller scale, but still providing good employment to several dozen people. So, we were hoping to inspire others to take similar actions throughout the labor movement and even unorganized workers. It didn't take off right away, but it did eventually lead to Occupy Wall Street picking that up and running with it. We would say there's a through line directly from that to then things like the Fight for 15 and then also the various teacher strikes, because amongst other things, and they'll say it, is the Chicago Teachers Union, the people who put together the fight that's been going on most of a decade there now and inspired then teacher fights throughout the country, including in red states where teachers don't even have the legal right to collective bargaining. They talk about how they were inspired by what happened at Republican Windows and Doors, and that's really important. Workers see each other fighting and having success. That's the kind of inspiration. Success begets success, and that's what we need to be doing. That's our obligation as labor organizations, is to be doing that in order to inspire others.
Well, that was a gutsy move, and it just shows you what solidarity can do and what can happen when you have a union behind you. I'm sure you never dreamed it would turn into what it turned into, but my hat's off to you and all of the United Electrical Radio Machine Workers for making that happen. Good stuff. So here we are, 2022, and you have this booklet. I know it came out a couple of years ago, Them and Us Unionism, which draws on your history, and I'm sure part of the Republic story is in there. And I was reading earlier, there's five core principles of your approach to unionism. Can we get into to some of them here, Carl?
Sure, absolutely. So aggressive struggle is one of them, and Republican Windows and Doors couldn't be a better example of that, figure out what it is you need to win and then find the way that you can fight to get it. And don't be shy about it. Rank and file control, it's what we were talking about a little bit earlier in the program, and local autonomy and democratic practices. That's why the members there, they owned their own local. They trusted it. They could make those decisions together. Literally hundreds of them were gathered together in the cafeteria, voting along each step of the way. Are we gonna stay in here? Are we gonna stay in here overnight, et cetera? Political independence. We don't attach ourselves slavishly to either political party. We believe the labor movement should be speaking in its own voice, and we should be trying to get the political parties to follow our needs. Too often, political considerations will be made at the top within a political party, and then labor's expected to follow it and justify it and go along with it. And that's a problem from our point of view. We don't give large amounts of money to candidates. What we do is we get candidates to convince our members that they're who are best for them, and then those members will go out and help them and do the people-to-people campaigning that's needed to win. International solidarity has always been an important part for us. We've got alliances on the ground with workers in other countries, not just these top-level delegations to union conventions in one country or another. We do worker-to-worker exchanges. We've helped each other on the ground. We've given support to independent unions in Mexico, fighting to try to organize runaway plants there. We have had unions in Mexico help us with organizing drives amongst largely immigrant workforces here in the U.S. That's the kind of direct worker-to-worker solidarity that we talk about. And frankly, an understanding that we're all fighting the same corporations and the same corporate power. Our enemy is not workers in other countries. You know, smashing up products that are produced in other countries might make somebody feel better short-term. It doesn't do a thing to actually improve the living conditions and working conditions for workers in either country. We have to lift up the standards in other countries in order to protect them and improve them here. And then lastly, uniting all workers. Our union was built in the 1930s. Up until that time, unions had been segregated by craft, by race, much to the shame of this labor movement up until then, by gender. We said, no, you have to unite everybody within the industry, regardless of their background. And in fact, again, Republic Windows and Doors is a great example of that. It was a, like Chicago, a very diverse population. Most of the members there were either black or immigrant, usually Latino. But there was also, you know, some of the older white workforce in Chicago, manufacturing workforce was in there too. We had a multiracial leadership. They all worked together because they needed to. What brings workers together, what can overcome some of this terrible right-wing racist violence that we're seeing in this country, is getting workers working together in a common interest. And that common interest is the working class standing up for themselves against those who are stealing from all of us in terms of the corporate class. And, it's frankly, I would argue, it's the lack of unions, especially in a lot of these kind of smaller cities and bigger towns that used to have factories that were unionized and we've been deindustrialized and those are gone. There's no unions to bring people together across racial groups anymore. People are segregated at where they live. They're segregated in church. And the unions, which were the glue that could bring people together, are gone. And we're seeing these right-wing demagogues exploit that. And it's definitely to the disadvantage of the whole working class and obviously especially results in further oppression for people of color in this country.
Yeah, the divide-and-conquer approach is definitely working in this country. It's real sad. Carl, we're just about out of time. One more question here before we let you go. How do you feel about unions today in 2022? I mean, you got a great history there. You see the organizing. You've seen the strikes that have been going on. What's your take on unions going forward?
Oh, I'm very optimistic that that unions are going to build much stronger than they are right now. The working class is ready for it. This younger generation isn't going to let it go. And people are organizing from the bottom up, which is key. That's how the industrial labor movement was built in the 1930s. That's how we're going to rebuild it now. So it's going to look very different a few years from now than it does right now. The existing labor movement, we need to be willing to be very flexible, make a lot of changes, not feel the need to stay the way we have been. The way we have been has not been working. The labor movement has been shrinking in many ways, for 50 years now. And it really got accelerated over the last 40 years, and we need to be open to new ways. And if we are, we're going to have a great labor movement ahead of us.
Carl Rosen, General President of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America, UEUnion.org, their website. You can also check them out on Facebook as well as Twitter. Carl, you're awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's do this again down the road. I love talking to you, okay?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, and have a great day.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Greg Regan, President of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO, coming up next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this next segment brought to you by the North Coast Labor Federation.
American workers are the best in the world, but we face an uphill battle against countries like China that don't play by the rules. There's a bill right now in Congress that would give American workers the trade tools we need to fight back and win. Join me in telling Congress to pass this bill. Visit AmericanManufacturing.org to learn how.
Paid for by the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit SurveyandBallotSystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, check out our revamped website, AWF Podcast. All the shows are archived there. You can still access through awfradio.com, but do check it out. A lot of good information on there, contact information, plus suggestions for guests for America's Workforce. So just check that out, awfpodcast.com. Let's go to Washington, D.C. right now. And joining us is one of our regulars, Greg Regan, on behalf of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. TTD.org is their website. Hey, Greg, how are we doing today, my brother?
Good, Flash. How are you?
Good, good, good. I see yesterday was National Maritime Day, the importance of the maritime industry. What was the significance of that being National Maritime Day, Greg?
Well, the strength of our U.S. merchant marine, our U.S. flag fleet, is really the backbone of our growth as a world power. And, you know, it's kind of sad right now that, you know, we pass a day like this, and you've got members of Congress who are looking to gut some of the core laws that made us a power in the first place, things like cargo preference and the Jones Act. And, you know, I hope that one day we recognize how vital those men and women are to our economic well-being.
Do you ever get the sense that they take the maritime industry for granted?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think there are far too many people who take it for granted. And you know, we currently have less than 2% of all cargo that goes in and out of U.S. ports is carried by U.S. flagged vessels. But those vessels that do exist, they're the ones who are move goods when we need to, when we have an international conflict or we have a humanitarian crisis. They are the sea lift capacity for the United States government. And they're the reason we don't have to rely on China or Russia or other countries like that to provide us with our sea lift capacity. So we should be thanking them. I mean, they're a vital part of what we do as a country.
Absolutely. All right. The next issue is, I guess, a research that was done by Carnegie Mellon. And this is interesting because, you know, you hear so much about automation, robotics today. Everything can be done by remote control. And it seems like they're trying to eliminate as many workers as possible, the human aspect of work. And apparently, this study shows that we need human operators.
Yeah.
We need them. If you want safe transit, we have to have that human element. I wonder if this is going to, does this have any legs here, this report in Congress? Because, you know, there's a lot of people that think differently, Greg.
If we have anything to say about it, it should have a lot of legs. Because, you know, this is a conclusion that we've made on our own. But I'm glad to see a sober, scientifically based report about truly what the benefits of automation are and also what the drawbacks are. I think as you see with an aircraft, for example, where you have a lot, you know, aircraft are more and more automated, but they're not trying to use that as an excuse to get rid of pilots. They're using it as a way to make the pilots better able to do their job in a safer manner.
Right.
And that's the way we need to be approaching automation when it comes to transit. It's certainly when it comes to rail, other areas, but you know, we should be looking at this as an opportunity to further empower the human operators right now and make them more able to do their job as safely as possible.
To assist the person, not eliminate the person. That's what this is all about.
Certainly now. I mean, we are still decades away from the idea of full autonomy when it comes to this technology. So if we're looking at this as a way to save a few bucks on people, then that's the wrong way to look at it. We should be looking at it as an opportunity, as a way to make things safer, a way to make things more efficient, better, and to empower people, not to try to eliminate them.
Well, hopefully we could take that over to the BNSF Railway, and I know this is a hot potato of an issue in America. Those of you listening right now, we all agree on one thing. There's a supply chain problem in America. Well, one way to fix it is to fix the situation going on at BNSF. So, Greg, fill me in, because I guess they're trying to make some changes, but they're not enough regarding their attendance policy. Refresh me and our listeners right now. Go ahead.
Sure. The attendance policy they're calling high vis is really it is an incentivization structure to maximize the work hours out of every single employee they have. So what you're doing is you give people a bank of points that are your leave days, and then if you take time off, they remove points. And if you exhaust those points, you get punished. And ultimately, if you exhaust them a third time, you're going to get laid off. But the way that the point structure works, it means that you're encouraging people to work sick, work if they're tired. They get penalized for taking time off, like family medical leave or sick days, things like that. And it's just a system that I think is just sort of blind to the fact that we're still in a pandemic, that rail workers, while they recognize going in that this is a difficult job, one that doesn't have traditional hours, they still need time to be able to care for their families. And the way this structure works, it just doesn't make sense. And there are people that I've spoken to who cannot foresee a situation where they're not going to be laid off within the next 8 months just because of medical needs and family needs, because of the way this is structured. And, BNSF made some modifications. They did not consult with their unions about the modifications, or did not talk about how they can do this collaboratively to make sure that their workforce has what they need. They made some changes around the edges and said, "Oh, we heard you." And I don't think it's right.
So hiring more people, they don't want to talk about that right now, because isn't there a work overload right now for the folks that are at BNSF?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, the BNSF is already, over the last year and a half, we've been facing desperate supply chain needs. They could not deal with the surge in capacity. They shut down certain segments of their system because they needed to deal with backlogs. They metered service, meaning that they told shippers that they have to reduce the amount of cargo that has to be shipped. And this is a result of them reducing their workforce by 30% in the 4 years leading up to the pandemic. Not because they didn't have the need, because they wanted to have better profits. And mm-hmm. now that sort of the chicken has come home to roost there, and they're scrambling to deal with it with things like this, like an attendance policy is to wring every last hour of work out of people instead of having a responsibly sized workforce and a responsibly sized cargo fleet.
And we need to point out, this railroad is being run by Wall Street. In fact, isn't Warren Buffett the chief investor in this in the railroad right now?
Oh, yeah. No, it's owned by Berkshire Hathaway, which is Warren Buffett's firm. And it is a hedge fund Wall Street mindset, how they're operating this railroad. And it's not just them. It's true with all the railroads now. And underlying all this is the railroad workers have not had a raise since 2018. They've been working throughout this pandemic, keeping our country going, and they've been locked in contract negotiations since 2019. The contract expired in 2018, and they're going nowhere. The railroads are offering basically if you looked at what the latest offer is, it would be a net zero, or if anything, a pay cut for the workers. If you want to fix the supply chain crisis that we have right now, one of the first things you can do, in fact, probably the most important thing you can do is get these workers a fair contract and make it attractive to work at the railroad again. And then we'll get it up and running.
Very sad situation. I hope they come to some resolve on that, because we have one heck of a supply chain problem in the United States of America. Well, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. I'd like to thank Greg Regan on behalf of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO, TTD.org. Until tomorrow, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.